Okay, so Meat and Livestock Australia funds research projects in key topics related to the role of red meat in a healthy and sustainable diet. And there's kind of three areas that we look at. One is healthy diets in the environment, the other is healthy diets by life stage, and then, of course, where does Australian red meat fit into all of this? So today we're really just going to focus on this healthy diets in the environment. And to help us understand this topic area, we've got two experts. We've got Brad Ridout and Howard Husbands-Parry. And we're going to discuss findings on the environmental impact of red meat within the context of a healthy diet. Now, Brad Ridout is Principal Research Scientist at CSIRO, and he has conducted a number of life cycle studies on the environmental impact of the Australian diet and what we might do to reduce it. Howard is the CEO of Pollinate, which is a strategic consultancy and an expert in market research. And in that capacity, he has done numerous studies on behaviors, which include food choices. And his insights will help us understand how we might communicate Brad's findings through our communications. So to start off, just to help as context, Brad, what's quite unique about your research is that it's based on Australian data, which is really important. I guess it would be good to explain why is that so important, and then by implications, what is the limitations of global evidence on sustainable diets?
Yeah, thanks, Vero. It's great to be part of the conversation here. Look, it really only makes sense that if we want to make diets more sustainable in Australia, we have to use Australian evidence because our food system has its characteristics that are not the same as every other food system in every other country. The environmental challenges that we face here in Australia, the resources that we have are not the same as elsewhere. And even the dietary patterns we have, as diverse as they are not the same as everywhere else. I'm not sure what a global average really is or means in any case. And most importantly, the public health nutrition challenges we have here are not the same as what's shared elsewhere. I mean, the nutrient that is lacking most or close to the most inadequately consumed nutrient in Australia is calcium. So some people talk about, oh, we need to give up dairy or something or other like that. Well, that's a very important source of calcium for us in Australia. It's not necessarily an important source of calcium in other countries that don't have a history of dairy food consumption. And one of the things our research shows is that people who avoid dairy, they don't tend to make up for the avoided dairy by consuming dairy alternatives, the cereal milks or nut milks or whatever it is. And when they're choosing them, they're not necessarily choosing the ones that are fortified. And so the lost nutrients from avoiding dairy are not necessarily being made up by other food choices. And actually, our evidence shows that the likelihood of achieving the recommended intake of dairy just falls right away. So every food system, every national context has its peculiarities. And really, I think we should use local information, not global averages and these sorts of things.
Yeah, and I guess it's similar for red meat. In Australia, we eat red meat. It's the way we get most of our iron and zinc. So therefore, it makes sense that we take that into consideration when we think about sustainable diets.
Well, of course, if you're thinking of changing things, people shouldn't make suggestions glibly because where are those extra nutrients going to come from? When you make food substitutions, you have a different profile of environmental impacts and you have a different profile of nutrition. And so one other aspect is important is to look at it in the context of the whole diet. So then we can say whether, the whole diet's improving or the overall environmental impacts of the diet is getting better or worse. And that's really important as well.
Yeah, so I mean, I like this whole notion of averages. I love that. And Howard, this whole notion of averages is sort of a little bit similar to this idea of food trends. When we talk about these food trends and we go, oh, everybody's becoming this or everyone's talking about that. To what extent does that reflect everyday eating habits, you know, and those peculiarities of individuals, and I guess even within the Australian context, you know, how different are we both? You know, I guess it's a two-part question. How different are individuals to the average, and how different is Australians to the rest of the world?
Great question. The latter point, how different are Australians to the rest of the world? And I'll tackle first and then talk about the average, which doesn't exist, of course. Australians are in many ways exactly the same as the rest of the world. We have two eyes, a mouth, we need to eat, we do what everybody else does. In other ways, we're completely different. And everybody in that sense is distinct and different. And I think there's a really good principle here called the principle of subsidiarity, which underlies a lot of sustainability thinking, which basically suggests that decisions are best made at the lowest common denominator in terms of locality. And of course, that's not strictly true. But what it really says is that if you treat everyone as an average around the world, you're actually doing most people a disservice. Because of course, the only person who's average is the person right in the middle. Everybody else is a few standard deviations away from that. And we live in a world of normalized data. In Australia, we see that with our HSC or with a lot of our educational systems, which is all about normalizing. The problem with that, of course, no one is normal. And wouldn't it be boring if we were? We want diversity of choice. I like my steak medium rare. Some people like it well cooked. That's fine. Whatever makes you happy. Still a steak. Whatever makes you happy. So I think it's really important to recognize that Australia and its food production systems and red meat here can absolutely be sustainable, whereas that same production system may not be somewhere else. So it's really important that when we look at this sort of Eat Lancet approach or this globalized data, we don't apply a finding that's general to everywhere specific, because that often doesn't work. Okay. As an aside, we looked at global data for MLA and we found that globally the trends were consistent, even though in every single market the data was completely different. So there's the proof in the data. In terms of within individual choices and food trends, look, without a shadow of a doubt, I think food is like fashion. And there's one tension that explains fashion. It's the desire to belong and the desire to stand out. Let's put it in Maslow, because every podcast should have Maslow. There's a need for status and a need for belonging. Now, with food, belonging is crucial. We have social norms. We share meals. We break bread. And culturally, some cultures, if not all cultures, are to an extent founded on their food. It's incredibly important. And food is the number one way that we accept new cultures. We take their food into our bodies. And it's incredibly powerful. Okay. At the same time, as we've seen with MasterChef, food is also status and power and difference and distinctiveness. So food trends are incredibly important. And I think that tension between the need to belong and share and the need to stand out and try something new and novelty and excitement of that is a fundamental power, if we like, that food has. And I think for red meat, for MLA, and indeed for Australian food production, to recognize that, to use trends and influences to really get us to try new and novel things and to change behaviors, but at the same time to help us to adopt, let's call them healthy, happy habits, that would be a wonderful nexus. I don't see enough of that. I think Australia's marketing is obsessed with making ads and awareness and getting everyone to do something instead of the hard work that is working with influence, working with recommendations and trust and advocacy that would really help to drive this. There we go.
I think, that importance of food really, I think, you know, this is a question for you, Brad, is that we think food and our food choices can solve a lot of problems. But actually, what your research has shown is that the environmental of making dietary changes is quite small relative to what can be achieved in production and waste reduction strategies. Why is it so small?
Well, one thing to point out first is that dietary change can make a big difference in terms of diet quality and health and well-being and that side of the equation. And let's not forget about that in our endeavour to reduce environmental impacts. But when we talk about environment, it's more than one thing. There's greenhouse gases, there's water, there's nutrients, there's pesticides, there's land use, biodiversity, etc. And it's not easy to improve everything all at once. In fact, our research has shown that these different objectives tend to constrain each other. Some foods are a bit more higher on one element and lower on another, and other foods are lower on that and higher on the other. So when we talk about improving all these objectives simultaneously, it's a very difficult problem, and we can only go so far because the objectives constrain each other. And the reality is, yes, that diets can be having lower environmental impact, but the environmental impact within the range of what is generally acceptable within the Australian community, you know, not sort of radical things that no one today even eats, shows that we could probably improve our reduce our environmental impacts by maybe around 15% by sorting around with the diet shifts and changes and this sort of thing. But 15% is very useful and positive, but it's not going to solve all the world's problems. So a lot of the heavy lifting is going to have to be done elsewhere in the food production side of the equation. But there are some things that consumers can be doing that start with not wasting food to begin with.
Just going back to the point about these many environmental indicators, and of course we do, you know, I always love the analogy that you describe when you've been describing your data, is that, you know, the more indicators you add to your evaluation, the blurrier the differences between food become. And of course, that is how we love to select food. We're like, oh, which is better than the other one? But actually, what this seems to show is that it's less about which food you choose, but more about how much you eat. And I guess there is a limit to how much less you can eat. You actually do need to eat to be healthy. So, back to that environmental indicators, which are the most important, do you really think, you know, from a food production point of view? Because we always focus, obviously, climate is really important, and water and cropland. And I know you're looking at pesticide toxicity. What else do you think is important in terms of sustainable production of food?
Well, also the nutrients, the fertilizers that are used, or not necessarily the use of the fertilizers, but the loss of the fertilizers that cause damages when they leave the farmland and move into our waterways and environment. But this is an example where local assessment is really important, because most of our land is lower rainfall, lower productivity. We've got a vast land area where the levels that fertilizers are used to per hectare in Australia are a lot smaller than in some high productivity croplands in Europe and elsewhere, in the US and places like this. So if you go to Europe, they focus a lot on fertilizer losses, nutrient emissions into waterways, because they have a hot, heavy, intensive agricultural system on a small land area, which has a lot of enclosed waterways and groundwater being used. Whereas these problems, yes, they are relevant in some parts of Australia, but they're not generally as relevant as they are in Europe. So this is once again why what is sustainable there is completely different to what might be sustainable here, and the importance of using local data, local analysis to inform what we're doing.
This notion of trade-offs is very interesting, isn't it? And it's definitely something, Howard, that seems to come up quite a bit in the behavioural sciences. How does that work a little bit with healthy diets? Because we always sort of think about healthy diets as, you know, we could just tell people, if we could just explain to them how to eat healthily, job done, you know, and of course we know that's not true. What are those different trade-offs going on, and how can we better understand that to help people eat as they would like to eat healthily?
Yeah, I was thinking actually in preparing for this podcast, I was thinking about what's the difference between healthy diets and guidelines and education, knowing what's healthy to eat, and say driving. And safe driving, and say speed limits. And I thought, well, we all know what the speed limits are. There's usually signs at the side of the road. It's actually a criminal offence to speed, and yet people do. The only reason they do is that they can, and they habits and bad habits and speeding. The truth is, the reason that we've got speeding down is enforcement. You get caught. It's enforced. You get penalized. There's a cost for not running that. Now, why is that? Well, because it's a collective thing. If I crash and kill someone else, then I'm guilty. Well, think about diet and what I eat. Well, that's me. That's up to me. And who are you, Brad or Vera, to tell me whether I can be thin or large or whatever I want to do, or eat chocolate every day, or, you know? And we have this notion now, therefore, that I'm somehow going to obey the rules, if you like, around healthy eating, even though humans are hardwired to not obey rules. So education simply won't work. Giving people more and more education won't work. We know this from work we've done with MLA, where most people say that I know what the size of a portion is, and they are aware of the correct size of the portion. And if you ask them, they say, I do indeed only eat the correct portion, but nobody else does. The maths of that don't add up, because clearly there's quite a lot of people out there who are slightly larger than they should be, and a lot of people eating more portion sizes than they should. And that's part of the waste that Brad's come across. And the reason for that, as you said, Vera, is trade-offs. People use heuristics, shortcuts to make sense of complicated situations. My favorite was always the Diet Coke and chocolate cake. I'm going to have chocolate cake. I probably shouldn't. It's okay. I'll have a Diet Coke with it. And the heuristic, the shortcut, is classic human thinking that cancels out that. It doesn't. You're still having the chocolate cake. The other one's just empty calories. Oh, but it's not a full fat Coke. I'll leave that there. The point is, humans are hardwired to only understand cause and effect. We look for maximums and minimums. We look for balance, one canceling another one out. We're really bad at looking at systems, delays, accumulations. We're really bad at feedback loops, which is why most of the decisions we make are often have an unexpected surprise down the line, or what they call a policy surprise or policy failure. Okay, so the trade-offs that people make are usually common sense trade-offs, and we see them all the time. And they rely on indicators, health star ratings, more stars good. And the more we can make it easy for people, the better, frankly, they actually make decisions. The challenge here, of course, is that with a complex system like diet and nutrition, or climate change, or agricultural production, it's not straightforward. As Brad says, there's no one food that's more sustainable than another. There's a few that clearly are, but really, you know, there's always a trade-off. And so what we have to do is I think, to help the consumer by trying to align. I want to make a healthy choice for me that's aligned with a good nutritional goal for me. And is that also a more sustainable choice on with regard to things like ecology, carbon, and water? And at the moment, that's really hard for the consumer to do. Really hard. So that's why they default to things like organics if they can. And frankly, they're just hoping that it's better.
Yeah, and I think that's that point about, you know, there's no sustainable food. It's almost like it's not about the food, it's about the habit in a way. So, Brad, really, what are those sustainable habits that can help to reduce the environmental impact of a healthy diet?
What our research has shown is that about 50% of the variation in environmental impact between diets in Australia comes from just how much people eat. So anything that can be done, I know we've already talked about portion size and the challenges that presents, but anything that can bring us back to eating what we need, and that's only in our own interest anyway, because if we're eating more than we need, then that's not going to help our health, and it's certainly adding additional burdens to the environment. So maybe it's not so much about eating less, but it's about eating the right foods, foods with plenty of fiber and protein that fill us up so that we're not, you know, back at the refrigerator, you know, an hour later, that sort of thing. But that's something that dietitians should have very expert ability to help people with. On the other side of the equation, that, you know, I know it's not sexy and we've talked about food waste, but it is such a big issue, because the evidence is that maybe a third of the food we buy, we throw away. No one admits to it, but bin studies reveal the truth about it. And we all feel bad about it and don't believe that it's us. But there's a lot of food waste that's happening. As Howard says, the mass doesn't add up. So practical things that people can learn about, you know, making a shopping list or understanding use by, best before dates, knowing how to store food or what to do with food that's a little bit closer to its end of life. But, you know, if we want, but the one thing that we don't eat enough of in Australia is vegetables. But unfortunately, vegetables are the most wasted food category of all because they're so perishable. I mean, processed food can sit on the shelf for a long, long time, but vegetables, they have a short shelf life in the refrigerator. So if we want to encourage people to have a healthier diet and eat more vegetables, you know, the big danger is we're going to have even more food waste. So this is something that ought to be a priority and ought to have a higher profile within the nutrition community to the extent that they're able to help with that.
And I think, Brad, that's a brilliant point about an unexpected policy surprise. We want people to eat more fruit and vegetables. Apparently, that's the biggest thing. I'll take that from you. Okay. Unfortunately, that's also the most wasted thing. So from a climate change, sustainability, and frankly, ethical production method, unless we understand the behavior failure around food waste full stop, there's no chance that we're going to end up back in balance here. We're actually going to shift the burden from one side of what I choose to eat and the proportions of different things on my plate to another side of, like, I've changed the proportions of my plate, but the net balance is still the same, i.e. still not positive. And I think that's crucial that we unpick the whole system. Everybody's got a part to play, the producers, the processors, the retailers, the consumers. What I think what I'm seeing here, Brad, is a beautiful synergy between your data at CSIRO and what I'm seeing from consumers. Consumers have got guilt fatigue. They want to make better choices. You've clearly identified, Brad, that it's not straightforward. We have to start stitching things together. That's what everybody wants. Everybody wants the alignment between making a good choice that's a value for money choice, that's a great meal tonight for my family that we're all going to enjoy with no waste, that's also of nutritional benefit and something we'll really enjoy. That shouldn't be too hard, surely.
I mean, this is interesting because every time, you know, in a funny sort of way, this always comes back to balance, right? So, Brad, you're talking about balance. Howard, you're talking about balance. And we know from nutrition, we need to follow a balanced diet. But the funny thing is, we never tell anybody how to achieve balance because your balance is going to be different to my balance, and that's going to be different to Howard's in terms of, you know, how do I want to lead my life, what foods I want to choose, that sort of thing. Now, you know, Howard, you know, you've been talking about this thing about heuristics, you know, that people love heuristics. We want to make complex things simple. We want a label, we want something. Just tell me what to do, make it simple. Is in a funny sort of way, this notion of portion guidance or waste in a way of just, you know, making everybody count sort of idea, is that sort of a single idea which can be a simple heuristic? I mean, how one would do it is another question, but is that a simple heuristic that could resonate?
I was actually toying with this issue before, and I was thinking, is food currently available in the right portion sizes? And the reason I mention this is I was out for dinner when COVID lockdown ended with about a dozen dads from my neighborhood, and one of them, and his gentleman's he's a smaller gentleman, he's not a very stout gentleman either, so he's a little shorter than me and diminutive, and he was just finishing off his tomahawk steak when I joined him, and I would put it to you that the steak was about the same size as he was. I'll put it another way. That was a very large steak and a very good steak, I should say. And I had steak envy, and I then ordered a steak. The point is, I didn't order a tomahawk because it's a vast amount of meat for a person to eat. And I was thinking after that event, thinking, how often are we given the option to buy portions that are not already an appropriate amount? And I was buying sausages for my son the other day. Some sausages were little, some were enormous. And when he chose the beef sausages, they were the enormous ones. And I was thinking, he's 10. And I'm just putting it out there. The heuristics here can be guided by the way we present food, whether the way we communicate it, the way we talk about it, the way we glorify it. There's a joy to eating a steak. I don't know about you, but when I get to the kilo end of the steak, I'm usually struggling a little. I had a lot less joy by the end than I had at the beginning. So I'm just putting it out there. Heuristics here are what we're using to make sense of food choices because they currently don't make sense. And I think we could all look at their food system in terms of it's bloody good food we produce in Australia. It really is amazing. And the quality of food is extraordinary and the choices we have are great. I think the heuristics people are applying are really to help them to try and navigate better choices. And I think it's incumbent on us to help them with that.
I think, yeah. I mean, look, I think that's, having been a dietitian for a while, I think that this notion of how do we create that balance on the plate, how do we create that balance in the diet is a real opportunity to help people, because I think people do know portion size, but that's not always applicable to them. If I'm having an active day, I'm going to need a slightly different portion size. What's the relative portion size of different things on my plate? How does that portion size differ if I'm going to have a sandwich versus a stir fry versus, you know, a meat and veg meal? So I think, you know, I think that there is quite a lot of complexity to that, but it, I guess it's a simple idea that we could possibly explore in terms of how we might address quite a number of needs within the, you know, within drivers of choice.
Absolutely. And don't forget, every time I go to Coles, if I choose to go to Coles, not Woolworths, I'm told that down, prices are down, 2 for 1, buy 2 kilos, not one, same price. I'm not going to argue and go, oh, can I just have half a kilo? I'm going to do what every consumer does and buy twice as much for half the price. And I feel like I've got a bargain. I've been trained to think that I've got a bargain, but I've got 2 kilos of mince all of a sudden. Did I need 2 kilos of mince? No, but it's half the price. So value comes in here as opposed to values. I might want to eat sustainably and waste less. That my values. That's what I think is important. To Brad's point about sustainability, we know that's crucial. That's the biggest thing we can do is waste less. But at the same time, from a value persuasion, 70% of Australians buy, or 70% of Australian groceries are bought from Coles or Woolworths, and they're both driving consistently down, everyday value, pricing. And that's the equation, I think, that gets tripped up. At point of sale, I'm going to get what I can, maximize value for my grocery shop. And of course I do. That's my obligation as a grocery buyer, as a family. But when I get home, I've now got to deal with 2 kilos of something where I only needed one before.
And interesting, when COVID hit and everybody's buying mints and, you know, with toilet paper, we gave out a lot of information about how do you freeze and thaw meat, and it was incredibly popular. So, you know, going back to providing those really common sense sort of ideas can really be, you know, a simple way of helping people adopt these sustainable habits.
And as we know, the science is clear. When common sense and science conflict, people always choose common sense. So the heuristics really kick in here because people need to make sense of something complicated. The problem with heuristics is they're often wrong. We choose something that just makes sense to us, and we're not giving them the guidance. We're not making it easy to align. This is a healthy choice. It will save you money and it's good for the planet. We're forcing the consumer, and they're burdened by this. And all the research we have says the consumer has guilt fatigue. They are struggling to make sense of this complex equation. And unfortunately, no part of Australia, whether it's the food system, the political system, the retail system, no part of it's making it easy. We're quite happy burdening the consumer. And again, Brad and I are in lockstep agreement here. The scientific data and the consumer research is consistent. The consumer is confused, they're feeling burdened, and they can't solve it themselves. It needs to be everyone working together. We've got to make it easy for the consumer. And you know what? If you make it easy for the consumer, they'll just carry on. They'll carry on choosing us. They will reward us for making it easier. So the opportunity is to get more loyalty, more custom.
So that's pretty much the answer for whether we're trying to achieve benefits for industry or benefits for public health. We need to get common sense and science to be aligned. And that's the challenge for our research program. It's a good place for us to end and a good challenge for us to keep working on. Thank you, Brad. Thank you, Howard. And enjoy your day.
Thank you, Vero. Delightful to be here.